Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is out now, and it's all about AI and creativity. I speak to Doug Eck, Senior Research Director at Google DeepMind.
Creativity is part and parcel of humanity.
YouTube creator Danny Vidari.
AI can give us humans new ideas.
And Neil Maiden, Professor of Digital Creativity at City University London.
AI creates a lot of opportunities. I think it's a great leveler.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts. Enjoy.
The FT.
Claiming compensation for PPI and card protection insurance, your rights explained. China, why the best investments are not always the companies you think. And are solar panels really a better way to finance your retirement than an annuity, as one minister claimed this week? Welcome to the FT Money Show, the FT's most downloaded podcast. I'm Jonathan Ely, and I'll be giving you all the money news this week in downloadable form, with the help of my FT colleagues Joe Cumbo.
Hello.
And Elaine Moore.
Hello.
Plus a special studio guest, Raphael Halpin, of the FT's premium research service China Confidential.
Hello.
This week started with news that Lloyds Bank is setting aside another £1.8 billion for compensating customers who were missold payment protection insurance. Of that total, £300 million was for claims they'd already defended. In other words, Lloyds was forced by the Ombudsman to pay up for compensation claims that it had previously rejected. That provision takes the total bill for PPI compensation since the claims began in 2011 to almost £20 billion, equivalent to more than 1% of Britain's entire annual economic output. No wonder that banks are once again pressing for a time limit on PPI claims, although so far they haven't made much headway with that. And on the same day, the city regulator said that a compensation scheme for another form of mis-selling, credit card insurance, would also open for business. But how do you know if you've been mis-sold a policy? And how do you make a claim? And what do you do if it is rejected? Elaine Moore is here to explain. Elaine, the PPI saga has been rumbling on for about 3 years now. Can there be anyone left in Britain who isn't aware that they might be entitled to compensation?
I think there can, actually. I think that although everybody will have received those very irritating text messages telling you to reclaim, you know, £3,902, and although you may have seen adverts on the TV from these companies called claims management companies also encouraging you to reclaim your PPI in exchange for giving them some of the money that you get back, I think that that has become kind of background noise now. And I think that the other really interesting thing that we should remember is PPI, which is a really irritating, jargony little term, is not actually what some of this insurance was sold under the name of. So you might have heard of PPI, you might not have ever seen that word written on your credit card statement or your mortgage statement or whatever. It could have come under, this kind of insurance could have been sold to you under lots of different names, accident insurance, all sorts of different other terms. You might never have been told about it when you bought that debt in the first place. So I think that there are still quite a lot of people out there who just assume that they weren't sold it, and actually maybe they were.
Now, Lloyds admitted this week that it has been forced to pay out against previously defended claims. If your PPI claim has been rejected by your bank, but you think you've still got a case, what should you do?
Yeah, so I spoke to the Ombudsman, and it turns out that so many of the cases that are sent on to them by customers who disagree with the answer that they got from the bank when they tried to reclaim some PPI, there are some banks, Lloyds TSB, 9 out of 10 cases that are forwarded on to the Ombudsman finds in the customer's favour. So that means that there are hundreds, thousands of claims out there that are valid that banks are turning down. So what this means is that if you have applied for a PPI rebate and the bank says no, don't give up, keep going. You don't have to go to a claims management company. You don't have to pay any money to do any of this. You just have to take your case on to the ombudsman. You have to wait. You have to give the bank some time to respond to you. If they respond to you and you don't like what they say, you can then take it on to the ombudsman. But you've got to do that within 6 months of receiving the answer from the bank.
Now, the banks want a cut-off point for PPI. They want to put a line in the sand, a date, and say, well, beyond this point that we will not consider any more claims. Is there any chance that that will be applied? Do people need to hurry up?
Yeah, it's not enormously surprising that the banks are asking for this. If you think back to 2011, think what Lloyds said then, that it thought PPI would cost, and it thought it would be $3 billion just for Lloyds. This week, because they've had to raise their estimate again, it's now £10 billion, and that's just for Lloyds. Within the whole industry, it's up to $20 billion. Quite a lot of consumer groups I've spoken to have said $20 billion is no way the end of this. That this, the banks keep on and on underestimating how big a scale of mis-selling this product is. So the banks would very much like to set a cut-off point, because it means that then they would not have to deal with, you know, more claims from people that may not have even realised they've been missold PPI yet. The city regulator has had talks with the banks about this, and so it's out there as a possible idea. But this week, the regulator said that it wants to make sure that this is in the best interest of consumers. So at the moment, there's no chance of this, because it's just not sure that banks are dealing with customer complaints properly yet. As I've said before, you know, the ombudsman levels of the number of cases that it is finding in the customer's favour indicates that the bank's customer complaints services aren't brilliant at the moment. Having said that, the fact that this is out there as an idea means that you might as well get on with it. And if you possibly think you were sold something, you know, sold a credit card, sold a mortgage, sold a personal loan in the last few years, go and have a look at your statements.
And finally, there was also news this week on claims against a company called CPP for missold card protection insurance. What's that all about? Is that the same as PPI, or is that something different?
It's very similar to PPI, but it's different. So it's another mis-selling scandal. It's another form of protection on a loan that was missold fairly widely. The difference in this that's quite interesting is that CPP, the company, and the banks that were selling this form of insurance for the company have actually agreed to be proactive about providing compensation for customers. They acknowledge that this product was quite widely missold. So they are going to write to customers. There are about 7 million customers who were sold this product, and it could be up to £1.3 billion that is paid out to them. The amounts of money are quite small. They think it'll be about £100 to £300 that individuals receive. But the difference to PPI is that you don't need to go out and do anything. You can wait, and you will receive a letter telling you whether you were sold this product. And if you think you were missold it, you get in touch.
Elaine, thanks very much. There's much more about the claims process on our website at ft.com/money. And why not check out our comprehensive guide to complaining about financial services at ft.com/complaining. Bear in mind too that the Financial Ombudsman Service is free to use, unlike claims management companies, who will take a hefty cut of any compensation you receive. Still to come on the show, can solar panels on your roof really pay for your retirement? But first, let's return to the issue of emerging markets. It's been another week of volatility on world stock and currency markets. The main reason for this is that the US Central Bank is reducing the amount of money it spends supporting the markets each month. But there's another reason too, China. For two decades, China has been an engine of world economic growth, sucking in raw materials, providing cheap manufactured goods, and running up huge trade surpluses and reserves of foreign currency. But in late 2012, a new leadership team took over in Beijing, promising to rebalance the world's second biggest economy. China's new leaders want more domestic consumption, less corruption, and a smaller role for the state. Almost everyone agrees these are noble ideas, but achieving them is proving painful. Growth is still impressive, but it's slower than it was, and there are widespread concerns about private sector debts. China's stock markets have been dreadful performers in the past few years, and shares in Chinese companies have rarely been cheaper, relative to earnings, than they are now. I'm joined by Raphael Halpin, a researcher at China Confidential. That's an FT-owned service that provides business intelligence on China to companies and investors. Raphael, many thanks for joining us. You've identified three key planks to the reform agenda in China: a smaller state, a more robust financial system, and a crackdown on corruption. If we start with the role of the state, can you give us an idea how widespread state interference in China's economy currently is?
So the key thing here is that the Chinese government securing their policy objectives has taken priority over any development of a market-based system free from state interference. So really state control spreads throughout the whole of the Chinese economy and society. One example is the policy objective of keeping a lid on inflation, making sure prices are not rising too fast. So that means that some of the big consumer resource prices are set by the government rather than the market. For example, the price of electricity for residential use, and also all prices, gas for cars. Another key policy objective for the Chinese government has been the development of a globally competitive manufacturing sector. So again, electricity prices for industrial users are set by the government, but also other key input costs, for example, water, gas, and even freight, are not set by market demand, but by what the government perceives as the correct level of pricing. So then in terms of the financial system itself, the government dictates interest rates. These are set by the central bank at what seems to be quite a low level. So for example, the official one-year benchmark loan rate is currently at around 6%. But outside of the official banking system, in the shadow banking system, loans are generally around 10%, sometimes as high as 20% a year in terms of interest rates.
Now, we've heard a lot about this shadow banking system, this kind of unofficial lending network over the past year. There was an attempt to curtail it last year. What exactly is the shadow banking system and why is it such a worry?
So as we've mentioned, the financial system is really just a tool of the state. So that means that those areas of the economy that the government wants to support, particularly large state-owned enterprises, receive credit fairly easily. But those areas, especially the private sector, that are not supported by the government, find it harder to secure capital. That means there's a need for a shadow banking system, which is developed to serve those companies that are not being served by the formal banking system. That's a fairly normal development in any economy, but there are concerns about the shadow banking system in China, particularly the fact that a lot of the funding for the shadow banking system doesn't come from conventional deposits, but comes from investment products sold with little or even sometimes no information as to where the money is invested. And then there's another concern that the system is actually being used by official banks to circumvent restrictions on how much they can lend and who they can lend to. So a lot of the shadow bank system is actually off-balance sheet lending to get around those restrictions. And obviously that raises concerns that the shadow banking system is actually undermining the stability of the bigger official banking sector.
Now, China is famously corrupt. There's lots of sort of gory stories about backhanders and so on. But then lots of developing countries have problems with corruption. Why is corruption such a problem for the Chinese government in particular?
Well, firstly, there's the question of social stability. We've got many examples in the past few years of officials being caught benefiting at the expense of the ordinary citizen. And obviously, that's caused outrage. So increasingly vocal citizens, especially on the internet, are actually seeking out examples of corruption, and that anger quickly snowballs. And the fear is that anger is being channeled at the state, and that given China's history, there's a real concern that people are going to begin to start questioning the legitimacy of this unelected government. And then the second issue is that corruption is actually an obstacle to many of the reforms that the government wants to implement. So officials are able to personally profit from state control, and they're going to obstruct those reforms to roll back the power of the state. So the government is making very clear by clamping down corruption that those days are over.
Okay, now as the Chinese curtailed shadow banking system rein back corruption and encourage consumption domestically rather than placing so much emphasis on exports, that will create lots of winners and lots of losers. Many investors in the UK prefer to get exposure to the winners through companies who are listed in London and whose shares trade here, rather than those whose shares trade in China. Now, very broadly, which sorts of companies look to be the winners and losers as China transitions to this more market-driven economy?
Well, very broadly, these reforms are bad news for some of the traditional plays on China. So, for example, commodities have actually had a fairly good year in 2013, despite the slowdown in China. But if the government's looking to clamp down on shadow bank lending, and that's a very big part of broader financing in China, that's going to affect some of the investment-driven demand for commodities, which has been so important to companies such as Rio Tinto and some of the other big miners. And then you have the corruption clampdown. That's going to affect some of the kind of high-end consumer goods companies, for example, Burberry, as people have less disposable income to spend, particularly those that have generated the income through corruption. But also there's less demand for very ostentatious symbols of wealth now. So then in terms of the winners, some of the companies that are targeting the middle class in China, they're likely to do well. So, for example, companies like Unilever.
Thank you very much. That was Raphael Halpin of China Confidential. You can read lots more about the outlook for China, plus lots of ideas for shares and funds to buy in this weekend's FT Money. This is available on both Saturday and Sunday at all good news agents as part of the weekend FT. You can also read online at ft.com/money or on tablets, Kindles and other mobile devices. We're always interested in your views too. You can reach us on Twitter, the handle is ftmoney, and you can leave comments and articles on our website at ft.com/money. And finally, you can email us directly. The address is money@ft.com. On to our final item for today. Earlier this week, Energy Minister Greg Barker told a national newspaper that solar panels were a better way to generate a retirement income than buying an annuity. His reasoning was simple. Put your solar panels in the right place, and courtesy of the government's feed-in tariff regime, you could earn a return of up to 8% a year on your initial investment by selling surplus power to the grid. That's far more than an annuity will pay you, especially if you only have a small sum at your disposal. But is this really a sensible proposition? What happens if you die early? What happens if you live to 100? And what happens if the sun doesn't shine? Do you have to do without food? Joe Cumbo has been looking at panels versus pensions. Joe, is the basis of Mr. Barker's claims is this feed-in tariff regime for solar power? Can you explain how that works and how does it compare to the returns on annuities?
Well, the UK is hardly California, but you'd be surprised that it is possible to make a return from solar panels, as sunshine is not essential, just daylight. But the returns will depend on many factors, including, as you mentioned, whether your roof is facing the right way. Just to get into the feed-in tariff, now this was a scheme which was launched a few years ago. What it does is offer guaranteed cash payments to households who produce their own electricity at home using things like solar panels or wind turbines. You receive a fixed rate for the electricity generated and what you sell back into the national grid. Plus, you benefit from making savings on the electricity that you're generating yourself.
Now, advocates of solar panels say these returns are guaranteed because the government subsidises the unit price of electricity. But that's not quite the case, is it?
Well, what is guaranteed is the tariff that you're locking into for 20 years. When this scheme was launched a few years ago, it was quite generous, but then the tariff was cut recently and it can't be guaranteed to remain at the level it is. So what you lock into is guaranteed, but the tariff is variable.
Okay, and what happens if you move house or if you go into care? Can you take the panels
with you?
Well,
this is one of the main drawbacks of solar panels, is that you've got to pay the upfront cost of installing them in your house, which is about £4,500. It's going to take at least 7 years to get your money back on it. So you'll have to stay in the house for 7 years and then you might start to generate a return on it. And when you move, you can't take it with you. So you'll lose the income from that solar panel that you might gain from an increase in your property price of having the solar panels.
And presumably, of course, with solar panels, you don't get the things that you get with pensions. They attract lots of negative publicity, but you do get tax relief. You often get employers' contributions and so on. You don't get any of that with the solar panels.
Yes,
presumably.
It was a very simplistic comparison to say that the returns on a solar panel are 8% versus 6%, which is what he quoted on what you could get with an annuity. What happens is when you start saving for retirement, you get co-contribution from your employer, which is valuable. Basically, it's free money. So for every £100 you put into a pension, you can typically expect a further £100 back. If you're a higher rate payer, you can expect a further £25 back from the government. So for a £75 outlay, a higher rate taxpayer can get a starting pension investment of £200. So if you're thinking about diverting savings away from pension saving and into buying solar panels, you will lose out on that tax relief, and you will also lose out on that employer contribution, and you won't get that from a solar panel.
Thanks very much, Jo. It all sounds like the sort of claim that only someone with a taxpayer-backed index-linked pension for life could make. More about panels versus pensions on our website at ft.com/money and in this weekend's FT Money. Other highlights in this issue: City Fund manager Terry Smith looks at the shale revolution and concludes that, broadly speaking, it's a terrible investment. Merrin Somerset Webb looks at whether US companies can possibly match the expectations heaped upon them in terms of earnings. We have some good news for holders of Equitable Life with Profits policies. And if you're looking to remortgage, do it now, because rates for longer fixes are heading higher. If you want to add your own comments, let us know about a hot topic, or share your thoughts, you can do so via Twitter. The handle again is FTMoney, or go online, ft.com/money, or via email. The address is money@ft.com. We'll be back next week, but for now, it's goodbye from me, Elaine, Joe, and our special studio guest, Raphael Halpin of China Confidential.
For more downloads, go to ft.com/podcasts.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is out now, and it's all about AI and creativity. I speak to Doug Eck, Senior Research Director at Google DeepMind.
Creativity is part and parcel of humanity.
YouTube creator Danny Vidari.
AI can give us humans new ideas.
And Neil Maiden, Professor of Digital Creativity at City University London.
AI creates a lot of opportunities. I think it's a great leveler.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts. Enjoy.